Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America, James Barty, Washington. Today is Thursday, February 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Nigerian court orders President Tinubu's government to do something about the high price of goods within 7 days.
The ordinary people who constitute the majority of our people can no longer access basic food items, clothing and other materials, and so the government will have to intervene.
Analysts say Nigeria's discovery of shady foreign exchange claims signals a deeper problem. War in eastern Congo keeps children out of school. Zimbabwe moves to abolish the death penalty.
I think the victims also need to be incorporated because they also need to understand that the removal of the death penalty does not necessarily mean that the offender will go scot-free. They can actually be sentenced to life imprisonment.
And the East African community seeks to harmonize laws on genetically modified crops. Those stories plus our Black History Month presentation are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist Femi Falana is welcoming a federal high court decision ordering President Bola Tinubu's government to do something about the high price of goods and petroleum products within 7 days. According to the Daily Post of Nigeria, the court upheld the motion on Wednesday after the federal government failed to present counter arguments. President Tinubu held emergency meeting Tuesday this week with key ministers about the economy. Lawyer and human rights activist Falana tells me Nigerians are complaining daily about the rising cost of basic commodities.
What we did was to dust off an old law, that is the Price Control Act, enacted by the government several years ago, and the court upheld our submissions that the law remains valid and there is in place a price control board appointed by the government and which is sustained by public fund. And so what the court did today is to uphold our submissions and order the government to fix the prices of essential goods.
So was the government present in the court?
The government was invited and the case came up about 3 times. The government didn't show up, and so the court decided to hear us. The government didn't file any reply to the case.
First of all, how would you describe the cost of commodities for which you have gone to court? How would you describe it in Nigeria at the moment?
The prices have gone beyond the control of members of the public. The ordinary people who constitute the majority of our people can no longer access basic food items, clothing and other materials. And so the government will have to intervene. Just yesterday, the president directed, I think, the Minister of Agriculture to release some food from the government storage. But that's not enough. People are complaining. People are going to the street to complain about the rising cost of food items. And it's a daily occurrence. If you bought some food item yesterday and you go back to the market, the prices will have gone up. And we cannot continue like that.
What do you think is responsible? Is it because the commodities are scarce in the market or because people don't have the money to pay for them?
The government said yesterday, the Minister of Information did say yesterday that our country is not suffering from food scarcity and there's food in the country. But how many people can afford to buy the food? I mean, the food, you know, in town. Not many people. Most Nigerians today, majority of Nigerians are sleeping and going, you know, home, empty stomachs. Workers are being paid low wages because the government has continued to implement neoliberal policies dictated by the IMF and the World Bank to the detriment of the national economy, against the interests of the Nigerian people. And we are simply telling the government, come back and plan your economy and stop dollarization of the economy. You cannot dollarize an economy that depends on imports. We are losing so much. The naira is being devalued through dollarization. That is unacceptable.
Can the court really force the government to do this?
We are going to ensure that the government is forced to comply with the judgment of the court. Let the government come to court and say we are unable to comply. And there has to be a justification for saying that we are leaving the fate of our people. Yeah, we are leaving the fate of our people to market forces. It's not possible.
That's Nigerian lawyer and human rights activist Femi Falana. He was speaking with us from Lagos. Nigeria's central bank said this week it uncovered $2.4 billion in false foreign exchange claims after investigating backlogs of $7 billion due to be cleared. Authorities said the finding will reduce pressure caused by foreign exchange shortages and warned that false claims could harm Nigeria's economy. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The discovery of the invalid claims followed a comprehensive forensic audit by the consulting company Deloitte on behalf of the Nigerian Central Bank. The CBN described the discovery as startling and said the irregularities include invalid documents, non-existent claimants, and, in some cases, beneficiaries receiving unauthorized foreign exchange allocations. The bank also said some claimants received more than they had initially requested. CBN Governor Olayemi Cardoso said the bank will not honor invalid transactions. Economic analyst Ogo Okiti says it is a step in the right direction.
We are moving in the right direction. So given what we have now, it's about 50% that have been cleared, and we have about 50% to go. And whenever that is done, that should actually support and help for the improvement in liquidity. I think anyone found to be intentionally, deliberately, and by design wanting to defraud the federal government of Nigeria through the Central Bank of Nigeria, yes, I genuinely think they should be made to account for that.
It is the first time in 7 years that audited accounts of the CBN have been made public. Nigeria has been struggling with a prolonged foreign exchange shortage that has delayed economic progress, devalued the local currency, and worsened inflation. Authorities say the audit had become necessary in order to understand the problems with the central bank and the economy. The CBN has so far paid out around $2.3 billion in the valid claims, including money owed to airlines, manufacturing, and energy sectors. Economist and director at the Center for Social Justice, Eze Onyebere, says the audit will not fix what ails the Nigerian economy.
The eroded liability is not ready to solve anything. The currency's position in terms of the value is beyond the CBN and monetary policy. It's a whole lot about the governance architecture, whether it's in the area of fiscal policy, trade policy, industrial policy, education policy. You heard the CBN governor tell the House of Representatives that foreign tourism, medical tourism, and payment of school fees, education is being consumed about $40 billion every space of 10 years. That's $4 billion a year.
However, Onyegbere says the findings of the audit reflect deeper problems within Nigeria's foreign exchange system and must be addressed.
Commonwealth, foreign exchange, the resources of Nigeria have not been properly managed, and that they've been, over the years, systematically stolen, and the present economic conditions we find ourselves are not just a product of lack of resources, but outright criminal.
Taking office last year, President Bola Tinubu pledged to crack down on corruption and enact reforms to boost the economy. So far, the economy has not taken off, and Nigerians remain in a wait-and-see mode. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
A Zimbabwe social justice activist is welcoming the abolition of the death penalty in Zimbabwe. The New Zimbabwe newspaper quotes Information Minister Jenfa Munsweri as saying the cabinet decision followed grassroots consultations around the country. The death penalty will now be replaced by life imprisonment. Tendai Ruben Bofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He tells me he supports the decision because it is in line with the global trend to do away with the death penalty.
In line with global trends, as far as, you know, executing people is concerned, I do agree to a large extent with the position that has been made by the Parliament of Zimbabwe in abolishing the death penalty. And let's also remember that Zimbabwe has not had an execution in decades. I don't have the exact date at the moment, unfortunately, but it's been years since anyone has been executed. But there have been a number of people that have been sentenced to death in the recent past, but none of them has actually been executed. So we can say, in a sense, the death penalty was no longer, you know, in effect in Zimbabwe. What was just lacking now was for the law to be in place where they can repeal the law and remove the death penalty completely. So we'll see that even with the coming in of President Mnangagwa in 2017 after the coup d'etat, he was also against the death penalty because he believes that it's inhumane, taking into consideration the history that they also went through during the liberation struggle, and that he also alleges that he was put on death row and he was only saved because of his age. And so he says, no, that's not the right way to deal with someone, no matter what offense they've committed.
I hear your view, but yes. What happened to the victims who say, well, there got to be some accountability? Otherwise, the killers will continue to kill.
I think the victims also need to be incorporated when these decisions are being made, because they also need to understand that the removal of the death penalty does not necessarily mean that the offender or the perpetrator will go scot-free. They can actually be sentenced to life imprisonment. So the whole issue of them continuing to commit the same offenses is effectively cancelled out, because this person might actually end up just spending the rest of their life behind bars. It doesn't mean that just because they are not going to be hung or to be executed, they are going to be let out. No, if the criminal was eligible to be sentenced to death in the first place, because not everyone who kills is sentenced to death, no matter what jurisdiction or country it is, the judge looks at the merits and demerits of each case and looks at, you know, all these things like intention, was there planning, how vicious was it, and all that. So if a judge was to find you guilty of intentionally killing someone with, you know, malicious intent and was going to sentence you to death, it also goes without saying that if the death penalty is not on the table, then they're going to sentence you to life imprisonment.
Tendai Ruben Bofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Mbote in Washington. Today is Thursday, February 8th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. In the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, in addition to human and material damage, war is having a negative impact on education. People's can no longer attend school because of insecurity. This is the case in the city of Seka, 27 kilometers from Goma town. More from Zanet Nete Zaidi.
At Macha Primary School, one of the busiest in Sake, the classroom doors have been closed since the deaths and injuries from fighting in the area. Bwira Bakulu Jimi is the director of Macha Primary School. He says they had to suspend activities because of the bombs dropped by the M23. Even though they were in the exam period, they have to save lives first and then later can make up for lost hours. He thinks that as soon as there is a calm, they will come back to school and will ask the teachers to increase their efforts to recover lost material. Bwira highlights the impact of intensified fighting on school attendance. He says initially they had 1,283 pupils. Just after the war started, they lost over 100 pupils. Even though the school is free of charge, the war is a cause. He says some of the pupils are staying in camps for internally displaced people because of the violence. Others, whose homes were destroyed, can no longer return. Parents worry about their children. They say there could be serious consequences if their children do not go to school and remain idle. Bahino Mongo Bienda says they are afraid that their children won't be able to finish the year because of this war, which does not seem likely to end in a few days. The children are wandering the streets, and he is afraid that they will run into serious problems. All of these, they say, are the effect of war. Since Saturday morning, number of people have been leaving their villages for refuge in Sake. The latest news is that the M23 rebels are advancing toward South Kivu, seeking to completely cut off the road between the city of Goma and this neighboring province. For VOA Africa, I'm Zane Mnetizaidi in Goma.
One of Eastern Congo's most active rebel groups is attacking a community considered the last line of defense before the region's largest city of Goma, fleeing residents, said Wednesday, even as the rebels claimed they had no intention to seize it again. The M23 rebels in a statement, however, warned that attacks targeting their forces and or indiscriminate shelling of civilian population will be dealt with at their source, according to the French news agency. The M23, with alleged ties to Rwanda, detonated explosives in North Kivu's Sake city, 16 miles from Goma, residents said as they hurried from fighting between the rebels and security forces. The East African community is seeking to harmonize laws on genetically modified organisms used to improve food crops. This comes as regional lawmakers are consulting and scrutinizing policies of the 8 member states, an exercise that started on Tuesday, Moses Javier Rimana reports.
The East African Legislative Assembly started Tuesday to scrutinize policies of the 8 member countries on genetically modified organisms or GMOs. They want to harmonize national laws to be followed by the bloc. Gideon Gatpan is the East African Legislative Assembly lawmaker from South Sudan.
We are trying to find out if there are policies in place, and if they are in place, are they being implemented unanimously by EAC, or they are implemented exceptionally by each partner state?
Jacqueline Amongin is a regional lawmaker from Uganda.
Been scrutinizing the available laws in member states, and also in terms of harmonizing the laws, especially in regards to genetically modified organisms.
In 2022, Kenya became the only member state in the East African community to allow the cultivation and importation of genetically modified maize. President William Ruto's administration says that allowing GMOs was a means to unlock a supply chains and alleviate hunger for millions of people in the country. Caleb Amisi is a Kenyan member of parliament. He says farmers are still skeptical despite government allowing GMOs.
GMO has been accepted in Kenya in principle, but in practice is yet to be accepted by the majority of Kenyans. GMO crops often require higher amounts of pesticides and herbicides, posing a significant threat to the environment and biodiversity.
Abbas Mutumba is a large-scale farmer in Uganda. He says that he is willing to abide with what the government recommends.
We would like to continue producing healthy food because we produce for markets locally and internationally, and as well the food we consume. We want to continue listening to our leaders and our researchers.
The assessment of national laws in East African member states will end on Friday and will help the East African community countries to determine guidelines for using GMO crops or banning them. Moses Aviarimana for Daybreak Africa.
Ghana's Vice President Mahamadou Bawumia said he was ready to lead the nation in a campaign launch speech on Wednesday, pledging to revive the battered economy, fight graft, and boost the private sector if elected president in December. The 60-year-old economist was overwhelmingly voted presidential candidate of the ruling New Patriotic Party in November, teeing up a contest with former President John Mahama. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History presentation for today, February 8th. This year's theme is African Americans and the Arts. Viewers Kim Lewis spoke with Jesse Harlan, historian, journalist, TV personality, and professor, about celebrating African American contributions.
There's such a legacy of African Americans in arts and literature. Phyllis Wheatley is a great place to start, but there have been so many great writers over the years that you could spend literally lifetimes going back and forth trying to just appreciate the enormity of the African-American contribution to American art and literature.
How should Black history be taught today?
Well, first of all, we shouldn't be teaching Black history. We should be teaching American history. And African-American history is such an integral part of this country's story. In February, we concentrate on African-American history, but it really should be taught all 12 months of the year, because you can't understand the story of the United States without understanding the story of African-Americans. And that cannot be separated from American history. While we may concentrate on it in February, and rightfully so, because it has been ignored so much in this country, it should be taught all 12 months of the year, because the story of America is incomplete without it.
And also, just going back to the theme for this year, this theme, it just encompasses so many aspects of the arts: music, film, fashion, visual and performing arts, folklore. You mentioned Phyllis Wheatley in literature, language, culinary, and of course other forms of cultural expression. And this is all such a huge contribution. Looking at some of the influencers and achievers of today, who stands out to you today in some of these categories?
Well, of course, in the arts, you can't talk about poetry without talking about Nikki Giovanni and her huge body of work. The poetry of the United States would not exist in the way it does without talking about Nikki Giovanni. But Nikki Giovanni is one of our elder statesmen of poetry. You also have to talk about Amanda Gorman, who is doing such fabulous work when it comes to poetry here in the United States. And that's just in poetry. You have a whole burgeoning field of Afrofuturism that's being done in the United States. And you have people like Nnedi Okafor. You have people like N.K. Jemisin. You have all of these great writers like Colston Whitehead that are doing incredible things in Afrofuturism. Then you look at movies, you see people that are doing such great things like Ryan Coogler. You can't talk about African-American or American cinema right now without talking about Ryan Coogler and the work that he's done. So there's so many African-Americans that are doing fabulous things in the United States, and we can't talk about our American story, our American tapestry, without some of these artists.
Jesse Harlan is a historian, journalist, TV personality, and professor. He spoke with viewers Kim Lewis. And that's it for this Thursday, February 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for being our guest this morning. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I am James Botting, Washington, saying, have a great day and please be safe, whatever you do.